That was The World at One with Martha Carney. The editor was Manzin Rana and the studio director was Julian Miller. We've an aerial view of Kew Gardens now on Radio 4 as Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, continues her exploration of our changing relationship with plants over the last 250 years in Plants from Roots to Riches.
This is one of my favourite views of Kew Gardens from above. I'm high up in Kew's treetops, 18 metres above the lawns and flowerbeds, on a walkway suspended between a series of futuristic-looking steel supports. Up here, I'm eyeball to eyeball with the business end of the tree, the leaves. This is where plant life and chemistry is at its most active. With me is Tony Kirkham, Kew's head of Arboretum. Tony, up here you can really see how much of the canopy is designed to catch light, can't you?
It's about branch structure,
yeah,
and how those lateral branches are coming off that trunk and pushing out to get maximum surface area of leaf to capture maximum sunlight. You know, I marvel all the time at the way that they grow, the way that they form. And often we look at trees for their attributes that they give us in a garden, maybe for, you know, for autumn colour, for leaf colour, for flower, for fruit. But actually, these simple species like the common beech or the common oak that we have around us here, that attributes for a reason, and it's to survive.
The key to this is a biomolecule found in almost all plants and whose structure was elucidated in the early 20th century. Such was its significance that in 1915, the Nobel Committee awarded the chemistry prize to the German organic chemist Richard Wilstatter, singling out his pioneering research in plant pigments, especially the green pigment chlorophyll.
By its property of making possible the assimilation of carbon dioxide under the influence of sunlight, and hence introducing the synthesis of organic substances in the green parts of the plant, chlorophyll possesses extraordinarily great biological significance and has an extremely important task to fulfil in the economy of nature.
Wilstatter's Nobel Prize was a symbolic moment. It united what for several centuries scientists in many different countries have been gradually piecing together, an understanding of what is essentially the fundamental building block of all life on Earth, the process by which plants use sunlight to turn water and carbon dioxide into the most basic sugar, glucose. Any history of this amazing chemical process tends to begin with Joseph Priestley, who in 1772 was the first to realise that gases are important. But that's to overshadow the remarkably contemporary observations made a century earlier by Stephen Hales, whose day job was Vicar of Teddington and who conducted his botanical researches in his spare time. Historian Jim Endersby.
He was very inspired by Newton and by Newton's mechanics to really take plants apart as if they were machines and to think about how they worked. He talked about the leaves as being the lungs of the plant. He understood that that was part of the mechanism too. But then he actually says, and may not light also, by freely entering the expanded surfaces of leaves and flowers,
contribute much to the ennobling of the principles of vegetables. For Sir Isaac Newton puts it as a very probable query. Are not gross bodies and light convertible into one another? And may not bodies receive much of their activity from the particles of light which enter their composition? The change of bodies into light, and of light into bodies, is very conformable to the course of nature, which seems delighted with transmutations.
Of course, Newton envisaged light as corpuscles, tiny little bodies that had some kind of physical or material quality to them. So the idea that bodies of one kind might be converted into bodies of another is easier to imagine in the 17th and early 18th century than the idea of energy, as we would now think of it, being converted into matter. So Hales makes these extraordinary breakthroughs and actually pulls all his work together into a book called Vegetable Statics, the kind of founding document of plant physiology. The great Julius von Sachs, who is always credited in the 19th century with being the inventor of proper laboratory botany, he says of vegetable statics, Hales may be said to have made his plants themselves speak.
Von Sachs, a German botanist from Breslau, had begun looking inside the plant itself. Developments in microscope technology and in the understanding of the cell allowed Sachs to observe that chlorophyll is not scattered all around the plant cells, but contained in green structures within the cell, which he called chloroplasts. In 1862, Sachs showed that these were involved in the production of tiny starch grains, which the plant then used as food. Sachs's seminal textbook of botany was translated into English in 1875 by the then assistant director of Kew Gardens, William Thiselton Dyer. Contained within the book was the celebrated formula memorised by generations of schoolchildren ever since. Carbon dioxide plus water plus the catalyst of light reacts to give glucose and oxygen. However, it wasn't until two decades later, in 1897, in yet another continent, America, that two plant scientists, Charles Barnes and Conway McMillan, gave the process its name. Photosynthesis. It was now clear where it occurred in the plant, its requirements and its limits. And when you know that, you can begin to manipulate it. Researchers found that controlling the amount of light and carbon dioxide could have a dramatic effect on the plant. The commercial implications were obvious. Tomato farmers growing crops in constant light could reduce a growing season by months, and increased levels of carbon dioxide were seen to improve size and yield. And botanists are now embracing this technique here at Kew to improve the chance of successful reintroduction of vulnerable propagated plants back into the wild in Madagascar. Viswanbaram Saracen is head of conservation biotechnology.
What we are looking at here is yams from Madagascar or Dioscorea species. One is without the carbon dioxide enrichment, so that is growing normally, I would say, but it is not a very exceptional plant. But the other one, what we are looking at is, which is grown in a carbon dioxide enriched vessel. We have more leaves and better quality leaves, in the sense it has got more chlorophyll, it is high quality leaves. The leaves have already got a waxy coat over it, which help protect the plants. So that is the difference. So photosynthesizing better, you know, the biomass is increasing. That means this plant will do far better when they go out into the wild.
The impact of raised levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide on plants is often overlooked when we talk about climate change. For some plants, especially trees, this can represent good news, as it provides the plant with an increased ability to photosynthesize, grow and store biomass. This is starting to be realized globally. For example, satellite photos spanning the last 30 years are showing encroachment of the savannas of East and South Africa and the tundra regions in the Arctic by shrubs. Once, open landscapes are now becoming impenetrable thickets. However, in addition to increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide, plant communities are also being challenged with drier and hotter climates in many areas. So how will plants respond to this cocktail of climate change? One way to determine this is to understand the different methods plants use to photosynthesize. Routinely, we learn at school what's known as the C3 pathway. This is where the first product of photosynthesis contains three carbon atoms. There are, however, other pathways, and one of particular interest to the challenges of current climate change is the C4 pathway. Jane Langdale is a professor in plant sciences at the University of Oxford, and she showed me a striking image of these two processes in action.
In the foreground here, you've got rice grown as a crop. The seedlings you're looking at were planted 42 days prior to this photo being taken. And in the background is maize that was planted at the same time. And the maize plants are much bigger.
Yeah, 50% bigger.
Yeah,
maybe?
Much greater biomass in the same time. And the maize plants are carrying out what we call C4 photosynthesis, and it's much more efficient, particularly in sort of hot climates like they are in the Philippines here. And essentially what those plants are doing is much more efficiently converting light into biomass. That's as a consequence of the C4 pathway that they're using, the photosynthetic pathway that they're using.
So we have at least two photosynthetic pathways in plants, C3 and C4. Interestingly, evolutionary scientists have now discovered that the C3 pathway is the ancient pathway, and one used by all plants until around 60 million years ago. At this point, Evidence in the fossil record indicates the presence of plants containing the C4 pathway as well. This coincided with an interval in time when the climate became increasingly hot and arid. So how does this knowledge of these different pathways and their evolution then help us with growing crops, given our present-day climate challenges? One particularly ambitious programme addressing this is the C4 Rice Project. Its aim is to make rice, normally a C3 plant, into one that uses the C4 pathway with all its associated benefits of increased yield in a warmer and drier climate. This is far from straightforward, but as Jane Langdale explains, the key is to rectify a flaw that lies at the heart of photosynthesis, namely that in C3 plants, the enzyme known as Rubisco that first binds carbon dioxide into the plant performs less well in warmer climates.
C3 plants are not very efficient because in addition to CO2 reacting with Rubisco, oxygen does. And so there's this competition going on between oxygen and CO2. And in high temperatures, oxygen can win out. Right. And so therefore you reduce the efficiency with which CO2 is converted into sugars. So what C4 plants do is separate Rubisco from oxygen, and they do that by essentially having Rubisco compartmentalized in just one photosynthetic cell type that sits tightly around the veins in the center of the leaf, whereas carbon dioxide is fixed by an oxygen insensitive enzyme in cells that are closer to the edge of the leaf. And so what the C4 pathway is doing is acting like a turbocharger. It effectively takes carbon dioxide from the outer parts of the leaf, fixes it, and then shoves it into the inner parts of the leaf, where it's re-released and then fixed again by Rubisco. And that extra little turbocharge means that oxygen can't inhibit photosynthesis and therefore it's much more efficient. So there's a whole bunch of different enzymes involved. And then, of course, add on top of that, I keep mentioning these two cell types, that means the leaf anatomy is completely different.
So you've got to change the architecture of the leaf and also the molecular pathways as well.
Yes.
And does the evolutionary record help you here? I mean, if it's happened before in the evolutionary record, can you look at the differences between the groups which have been C3 and then C4?
Yes, so that's one part of the project that is going on, is looking at global changes in the expression patterns of genes in C4 versus C3 plants to see if we can identify ones that are always switched on in C4 plants and never switched on in C3 plants, for example, giving us candidates for the sorts of things we might need to change. And the fact that C4 evolved multiple times in evolution is certainly something that gives us great hope. Mm. There must at least have been some sort of preconditioning event that essentially got a whole group of plants in a position whereby it was much easier to flick that switch to go from C3 to C4 than otherwise might have been.
If it works, the C4 Rice Project could increase rice yields by over 50%. Scientists have made considerable strides in understanding other C4 food crops like maize, sugar, sorghum and millet, and these advances will be crucial in allowing rice to join this group. This has to be one of the most exciting and potentially important strides in science to address the global challenge of feeding an ever-increasing population. Understanding the different biological pathways and how these differences are spread throughout the plant kingdom is giving scientists a significant insight into the long-term fate of plants in a changing climate. However, some plants seem to be able to adapt and survive more easily than others. And as we'll hear, it took a chance encounter with an evening primrose to explain why.
That was Professor Cathy Willis. The readers were Clive Hayward and Ian Redford. The series is produced by Adrian Washburn. To discover more, search for Plants From Roots to Riches online.
Great Lives returns to BBC Radio 4.
This week's Great Life is a painter who's been described as the best British artist you've never heard of.
Matthew Paris will be exploring the lives of some of the world's most extraordinary people, beginning with the painter Edward Burrough.
He crams the canvas. He's a maximalist. For him, more is more.
What he did was get up quite early and paint till he was too tired to paint anymore.
Great Lives, starting tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 on BBC Radio 4.
Coming up after the news, it's The Archers.